Simon Hunt, consultant in the global economy, China, and the copper industry. Welcome to the Common Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you very much for having me, even though it's 6 o'clock in the morning my time.
Well, Simon, I always appreciate you getting up extra early, and this morning for you, it's an interesting time. We're recording this for myself. It's April 7th still, and everything seemingly happened while you were asleep. So
that's absolutely true.
in a way, you're coming at this with fresh eyes.
I've put my thoughts together, but probably later today they're changed.
Well, that's thing
when I move at such a pace. I went to bed with the news that America had launched attacks on Karg Island, and I wake up, there's a peace plan.
Yeah. You went to bed with the news that the B-52s had left and were headed towards Iran, and you wake up and there's a peace plan.
Yeah.
So with a ceasefire seemingly agreed to, what do you see as the next step? How durable do you think this is?
Well, I went to Al Jazeera to get the guts of the peace plan. And frankly, the peace plan is built around Iran's basic conditions for a ceasefire, which are completely unacceptable to Trump and the American administration. Here are some of the points. Controlled passage through the Straits of Hormuz in coordination with the Iranian forces, which would grant Iran a unique economic and geopolitical position. The necessity of ending the war against all elements of the axis of resistance. The withdrawal of U.S. combat forces from all bases and deployment points in the region. The establishment of a safe transit protocol in the Straits of Hormuz in a way that guarantees Iran's dominance according to the agreed protocol. Full payment of Iran's damages according to estimates. The lifting of all primary and secondary sanctions and resolutions of the Board of Governors and the Security Council. The release of all Iranian assets and properties frozen abroad. And finally, the ratification of all these matters in a binding Security Council resolution. So, how durable is this ceasefire going to be? Practically zero.
Well, I guess that's that.
From Trump's point of view, it relieved pressure on equity and bond markets, and back to the races, which is what many of his donors like to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the crude oil price fell something like $20 per barrel in a matter of an hour.
Yeah.
There's you know, it's interesting to see the market's reaction to this. It certainly, I guess, looks like the resolution or the agreement to this peace plan is being understood by the markets as being relatively durable for now. So
that's because they want their markets to go up. It's not reality, it's illusions.
So Simon, why don't we try to, let's say, conceptualize both sides of this? Let's start with trying to talk through what the ramifications are if this peace is durable at this point. Like, we can't immediately start shipping oil. We can't immediately start shipping fertilizer. It's not like everything just goes right back to normal. So what are, even if this peace is durable right now, what are the consequences as you see it for the economy and energy as a start?
Well, you've said it all by saying that things don't go back to normal immediately. According to different estimates, it's anything 3 to 6 months. And what has happened plus the 3 to 6 months means, first of all, inflation rises sharply compared to what it was pre-war. Here are some of the OECD revised 26 inflation numbers, which were revised the end of last month. India from 3.4 to 5.1. US from 3% to 4.2. G20 from 2.8 to 4. UK 2.5 to 4. And a few other notable ones. Germany from 2.1 to 5.1. Euro area 1.9 to 4.1. And so on. So, what does rising inflation mean for yields? 10-year plus yields are going to be rising. What does that mean? I mean, in our view, the fiscal and monetary stimulus that's bound to come through, not immediately, but by the end of this year, fourth quarter probably, we're going to be on an inflationary path aggravated by rising energy and food prices that will take us back to the sort of numbers we saw in 1979 and 1980. What does that mean for 10-year treasuries plus double digits? What does that mean for highly leveraged and indebted global financial system? You're going to see markets disappear into the undergrowth. That's the big picture that we see. But I think it's important also what were Trump's real reasons for attacking Iran. Sure, reason one, to support his big donors from Israel. But the bigger reason is that knowing that America's economy is in dire straits, heavily indebted, widening gaps between the haves and haves not, an inability to produce the goods that it needs and has to import, thus increasing budget and trade deficits. So he saw, and his advisors saw, the way out in that they are now the largest oil producer in the world. Let's build on that to control energy prices. If you control energy prices, you control the world. So action one, Venezuela, action two, Nigeria, and action three, Iran. And if he defeats Iran, then he has all the Gulf states in the palm of his hands. Problem, as he is finding out, is Iran is not like Venezuela, and that Iran is a durable opponent. It's an old civilization. Their people have gone through crises decades after decades for centuries. They're not going to give up. Added to which, Iran is a very important logistical hub in the BRICS group of nations. So Iran, as we know, has the full backing of both China and Russia. And actually, only a few days ago, Iran's foreign minister was in Moscow talking with Putin, and our guests, it's an easy guess that probably China's foreign minister was there as well. And it was on the 29th of January that China, Iran, and Russia signed a new strategic alliance. Basically, it says, if one of us is attacked, the other two come to our support. So this is all part of a much bigger picture. And the truce, probably it helps Trump domestically, politically, and it helped his Wall Street friends. But it's a, as I've just explained, that the 10-point plan of Iran's is not going to be acceptable to Trump. So this is only a postponement of the war. And in the meantime, is Israel going to abide by the ceasefire? Big question mark. Netanyahu does not want a ceasefire. It's the last thing he wants. This is his life's dream, and he can see it being fulfilled. So many questions. And the bottom line is, this is not going to be a permanent ceasefire. At most, it'll be a 2-week ceasefire. And given Trump's history, it may well not be 2 weeks. It may be just a few days. So, if this scenario plays out, which I think it will, the question then is, with oil prices 150, 200, are we actually going to see an inflation-led recovery, or do we just go straight into recession? I think Europe is poised to actually go first into recession, probably around the middle of this year. And if this war continues, probably into a depression. Russia and China come out well out of it. China has got reportedly oil reserves that will last them 120 odd days, but I suspect much larger reserves that are not reported. And in any event, any shortages can be made up from Russia and other neighboring countries. China has been building food stocks for years. They had a big emphasis on agricultural production, and they have been planning for increased tensions with America for at least the last 5 years. So the policy in China at the moment is stability, not stimulus. And the stimulus will come if tensions with America break out into something worse. Russia's economy is doing fine. The central, two years ago, the central bank cracked down on rising inflation by putting interest rates into, I can't remember the top, 22-23%. Now with inflation coming down, they're putting more liquidity into the system. And it was the tight credit system that, crashed is too strong a word, but which weakened the economy. When you include all the indirect inputs of the war in Ukraine into GDP, the war in Ukraine accounts for 38% of Russia's GDP. So that was growing at, I've forgotten the exact figure, 8-10%, something around those figures. So it's a very uncertain, unsettled global environment that if things pan out as I think they will, then China and Russia will be in much stronger positions in 2 to 3 years' time.
Is it possible, Simon, that this was, an attempt to weaken the BRICS alliance?
Oh, definitely. That was part of Trump's thinking. If we destroy BRICS, then we've probably destroyed, if we destroy Iran, we've probably destroyed BRICS. Another reason why China and Russia will be fully supportive of Iran. They've already been supportive in supplying sophisticated radar satellite equipment and S-300s, S-400s, etc. And both have got big investments in Iran. They're not going to let Iran go.
And that's because it's of such strategic importance as well. Logistic importance.
Logistically, it's key.
Mm-hmm.
The North-South corridor, various interlocking railways and highways. I mean, China has this 25-year investment program in Iran, not just in energy, but particularly in manufacturing, led by SOEs in partnership with Iranian companies. So using Iran's cheap labor as an export base into the West. I mean, that was engineered, 10 years ago? Time flies, 5, 10 years ago.
Simon, I think this also brings into focus the idea that more resource nationalism is going to be embarked upon by, for example, China, Russia, basically East versus West here. Do you see that as intensifying and, being a theme that only accelerates because of this war?
That's a very, very good question. If you take copper as an example, in January, China announced it was going to build an additional stockpile of copper in case of global tensions increasing. But I went back through all the data going back to the 1970s, and plus I believe that when the PLA sells equipment, it does not get paid in cash. It gets paid in metals. When I added it all up, I came to the conclusion that China has a reserve of copper cathode of between 5 million and 7 million tons. Add on to that, there's an agreement between Russia and China that Russia's surplus is, be careful what I say, is available to China at discount prices. Then you have to look at Zaire. Zaire is the battleground. I think it was late last year or early this year, America signed a new agreement with the president of the DRC, which gives American companies first right on any new copper or cobalt investments. Only the other day, the president of the DRC signed an agreement with China, deepening their relationship in the development of copper and cobalt. So you can see DRC is a real battleground between China and America. And I think this is going to continue. I think what we will see, not immediately, my guess is probably in 2 years' time, that for copper, the EU will start building a copper reserve, that America will. So that will be in addition to their first building a critical mineral reserve, and then copper will come second.
But how can the U.S. build a copper reserve without smelters?
Because you bid for cathode from other countries. I mean, Chile is going to be caught between their biggest customer, China, and their biggest superpower, America. How are they going to straddle the two of them in future years is going to be very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And then you look at Panama, Cobre Panama, and you look at Peru. China is not going to give up their investments in Latin America. So one could say that, in fact, can say that Latin America is going to be another battlefield. But much will depend on the outcome here in the Middle East.
Well, one would expect that if, you know, an empire that is breathing, let's say, its last gasps, you would expect there to be more wars, but ending up being closer to home. So that would also make sense from a kind of fourth frame.
I think ultimately, what we're seeing is the battle between those countries wanting a unipolar world to continue, and those countries that are building a multipolar world, that inevitably they have to confront, they will confront each other. And on our timetable, it's somewhere around about 2028, 2030. That's when we get the really nasty stuff.
So, Simon, does this also, you know, not only does this bring forward maybe more resource nationalism, but also kind of considerations for nations that weren't directly involved, let's say, like Taiwan starting to negotiate with China?
That negotiation has been going on for a long, long time, many, many years. And China has always said that Taiwan falls into the mainland on its own accord.
Mm-hmm.
Talk of invasion was talk, really. Now you have meetings going to be held in Beijing, I've forgotten when, next few days. I think it comes back to what Deng Xiaoping said years ago, 2028 is the year when Taiwan becomes part of the mainland.
Mm-hmm. How does this also play to Russia's hand as well? Do you see Russia being a more important part of energy exports to China, possibly Europe? How does Russia's station in the world improve or not by this?
I think in the real world, Russia's standing is increasing year on year because of Putin's political and diplomatic and legal approach to problems, particularly legal. I think that throughout the Deep South, Russia's position is not only improving, but is going to strengthen. As these countries see China and Russia as being stable partners, whereas America's stance changes by the day.
Yeah, it doesn't seem an environment or a geopolitical environment that is apt to create any type of confidence anywhere.
Exactly. I mean, how can any country leader accept what America says on one day and it changes the next day?
Especially when you go kill the negotiators that are going to be kind of negotiating for peace. How many times can you play that card?
Yeah, exactly. Now, I think one of the lasting consequences of this war is a perception by the rest of the world that America has forgotten the art of diplomacy. They have, instead of diplomacy, they use threats of brute force. Whereas if you look around what China and Russia say, it's very back to the old diplomatic model.
Well, at very least, you should be a stable and good faith negotiating partner. Never mind do what you say and say what you're going to do.
Yeah, to give a simple example, the two gentlemen who conduct foreign policy for Trump are not members of the government. They're personal friends and family members. That's no way to conduct diplomacy.
Mm-hmm. Do you still see the Ukraine as playing somewhat of an important role, both within the context of what Europe and the issues that they're going through and how that plays into, you know, an ongoing conflict there that hasn't ended? It's just been distracted from.
The Ukraine war will end on the battlefield. I've said that for a long time. And Russia will issue its conditions for ending the war and will basically say, accept them or not.
Mm-hmm.
Russia will take what it wants in Ukraine based on history. So that will include Kiev and other key ports.
I mean, how much energy, how much of the world's energy is offline for more than 6 months here, let's say?
For the next how long?
Let's say at minimum 6 months. Again, I'm just trying to get the sense of, you know, if this piece is durable, how quickly things can get back to normal, or if all of the damage done is, you know, far more long lasting and detrimental than many might think it is.
Well, if you go back to one of the conditions that Iran has put on the table, the Straits of Hormuz remains open, but on conditions acceptable to the ICRG.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the key words. Which countries are not acceptable to them? Any vessel owned or leased to America or Israel whether or not that includes Europe, I don't know, is not acceptable. So I've got no figure I can give you. What one can say is that if the ceasefire is permanent, Iran will remain in control of the straits, in control of what goes through the straits, and the two conditions are, one, that there will be a toll field for every vessel passing through, with a number being quoted of $2 million per vessel, which amounts, if you go back to pre-war, that means $8.4 billion per month of fees payable to Iran. All cargo must be paid for in Chinese currency or non-US currency. And that comes to, again, based on pre-war tanker vessel traffic, that means $850 billion a year. Big numbers.
Mm-hmm.
What I should have said earlier is, even in a ceasefire, will Lloyd's insurance cover the vessels?
Mm-hmm.
Because without insurance cover, no vessel will go through the straits. That's the key.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really on Lloyd's insurance thinking, is this a temporary ceasefire or is it permanent? That will be a very interesting indicator
mm-hmm.
for the future.
So is that the only option for tankers going through the strait?
I believe so.
So, Simon, what do you think copper can tell us about the road ahead for the world economy? What, and explain why you're laughing.
I'm laughing because it's a race between demand destruction and supply destruction. Who wins that race will tell you what the price is going to do.
Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily the forecasting ability of copper to be able to tell us what.
No,
yeah.
No.
Mm-hmm.
Well, copper's forecasting ability was lost long ago because financial markets and certain big players threw money at copper, which was the opposite to what the fundamentals were saying. The fundamentals be that in 2024, there was a surplus of about, in round numbers, 300,000 tons of copper. Last year, there was a surplus exceeding 700,000 tons. And prior to this war, we had a surplus of around 500,000 tons.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I began by saying, which is going to fall the faster, supply or physical consumption? On the supply side, you've got the impact of falling phosphor that comes through the straits, that's turned into sulfuric acid, and you have a shortage of diesel. And it's probably the shortage of diesel that will have a big impact on production capability in the DRC and Zambia. Rising energy prices, rising costs of production. On the demand side, the rising costs of energy will impact physical consumption. But what I'm picking up is that the boom in data centers is causing a boom in future forecasts of copper. 70% of copper used in data centers is wiring. But companies that actually install wiring systems in data centers have been increasingly saying that even in the racks, not just leading up to the racks, that fiber optics is substituting copper. Then only 2 days ago, I came across a development of NVIDIA's. They have bought two companies that are experts in photonics, and that it's a $4 billion bet they paid for these two companies, that by, if not before, 2028, NVIDIA will not be using any copper wiring.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be fiber optics for technical reasons. So, I think other than the macro environment, which if we're lucky, we get an inflation takeoff, which means everybody buys copper, everybody replenishes copper inventories right through the semi-manufacturing chain. So you get a big runoff in copper prices. But against that, if, as I suspect, that the war in Iran is, the ceasefire is only temporary, and that we see rising energy prices, that will make monetary and fiscal stimulus very difficult to balance. And then not only substitution in data centers, I mean, I'm hearing from my friends in China that aluminium is increasingly being used in low voltage cables and in the wiring and tubing of air cons. It's the big global air con leader, Daikin, started using 2-3 years ago after 20 years of research. So always throughout history, high copper prices means more substitution.
Mm-hmm.
So where do copper prices go? I suspect that over the next 6 months, we will see lower copper prices than today's. And if we're lucky and we get the inflation takeoff, then we will see an explosion of copper prices. But in 2026 dollar terms, it's probably more or less the same as today's prices.
Hard to think that an inflation takeoff ends up being the lucky scenario.
Oh, when you have an inflation takeoff, it's always followed by a crash.
Yeah. So what else, like, is it all commodities that take off in that inflation takeoff?
Yeah. I mean, I think where one should be focusing on for households is food prices.
Mm-hmm.
Food prices are going to soar over the next 2-3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Because of weather conditions, energy prices, We're going to go back to what we saw in 1979, 1980. So house cells should keep their deep freezers stocked full. And if they have gardens, convert some of the garden into a kitchen garden. Mm.
So how important does gold become in this situation as well?
Gold remains the secure asset. It always has corrections, always will have corrections, but in an uncertain world and one where inflation is likely to be rising, gold is a prime asset to hold as it retains its value.
Mm-hmm. Simon, is there anything else that you're keeping an eye on or that we should consider before we wrap up?
I think that we should pay attention to capital flows. Here in the Gulf, their surpluses have flown into US and European and other markets. Now they will need to prop up their economies. We can see a reversal of that flow coming back into the Gulf countries.
Mm-hmm.
Longer term, I think one of the consequences we need to watch very carefully, and this is not a forecast yet, is, are we going to see the current political structure of the Gulf countries changing? I think also if Iran outlasts, if not defeats, America, and that America and other foreign countries withdraw their military and financial assets out of the region, then we are going to see Shiite and Sunnis working together instead of foreign countries' ability to create this rivalry sentiment. So post-crisis, I think the Middle East is going to be far more stable region.
Well, there's certainly a lot of things still up in the air, Simon, and I appreciate you speculating a little bit and talking through a lot of this with me. It's, you know, there's a lot that needs to be thought about and understood, I think, from the average person's perspective. And hopefully that extends up the chain of command, if you will.
Good. Well, thanks for having me, Tom.
Always a pleasure, Simon. And for those that want any more of your writing or forecasts, it's all available at simon-hunt.com or shss.substack.com.
Like simon@shss.com.
Yeah, that's your email.
Yeah.
So, but you have your Substack as well, where you post small podcasts and articles as well.
Super, Tom.
Thank you, Simon. Always a pleasure, sir.
In time for tennis.
Perfect.